even to discuss the changing role and significance of the humanities seems to presuppose that there's some coherent grouping of human cognitive disciplines designated by that common name, and that the disciplines thus designated in some sense belong together, at least to the extent that they can reasonably be made the object of a single unitary discussion. In what follows, I'd like to question some of the tacit assumptions about unity that seem to me to lie behind ways in which the humanities have been understood, and I'd like to do this through a discussion of the development of what was once a central humanistic discipline, namely philosophy. Human beings are weak, and we live in an uncertain and potentially dangerous world. One way in which we try to cope with this situation is by organizing what we observe, grouping together different phenomena, and classifying things. Order seems in itself to be reassuring, and one way of imposing order is by discovering the origins of what we encounter. If we know where something comes from, we have the sense that we at least know in some vague way what to expect from it. What is probably the oldest extant document of Western literature, the Iliad, provides a number of striking examples of this human tendency to ask for origins. In Book 6, Homer describes an encounter on the field of battle between two warriors who do not know each other. They turn out to be Diomedes, a Greek, and Glaucus, an ally of the Trojans. Before they fight, Diomedes asks Glaucus who he is, and Glaucus replies by embarking on a genealogy reaching back five generations, which contains a series of elaborate narratives of what his father and his grandfather and various of his ancestors did at various points in their lives. When Diomedes hears Glaucus' stories about his ancestors, he realizes that his own grandfather and Glaucus' grandfather were hereditary guest friends, and so the two warriors decide not to fight with each other after all, but instead to exchange armor in token of a renewal of this relation of guest friendship. When they have determined who they each are via their respective genealogies, this is taken to have important normative consequences for how they think it's appropriate to treat each other. The question who one's opponent is seems in this world to be a perfectly natural one to ask, and it also seems natural to answer that question, even in the heat of battle, by giving a genealogy and a series of narratives. Who I am and what my essential properties are is thought to be connected with my origin, which is given by the genealogy. And the genealogical narrative is assumed to disclose something important about my essential powers, obligations, and entitlements. Oddly enough, this genealogical interest in origins does not seem to have developed into an intellectually hegemonic discipline in the ancient world. Rather, at a relatively early stage, it was crushed and pulverized between two huge millstones, which to some extent represented competitors to genealogy. And these two millstones were, on the one hand, rhetoric, and on the other hand, philosophy. To start with the first of these, rhetorical culture was focused on producing persuasion through the medium of correct, aesthetically attractive, and effective speaking. Rhetorical training meant the study of languages and of language in all its aspects, but also the inculcation of certain aesthetic, moral, and political values that were also considered to be part of being a persuasive speaker. In discussing ancient rhetoric, it's important not to lose sight of two important facts. First of all, rhetorical training was in the first instance eminently vocational and practical, not abstract or merely ornamental. Ancient rhetoricians were, in the first instance, competitive participants in the rough and tumble of everyday politics, not mere spectators or theoreticians. Rhetoric as a discipline skill seems, in fact, originally to have had a close connection with proto-democratic politics, where such skills would be particularly valued for obvious reasons. The second important fact to keep in mind is that rhetorical training was not, contrary to the propaganda of Plato, originally just a technique for unscrupulously manipulating people. To put it in a somewhat later terminology, the original project of rhetoric was to teach something that was both inherently valuable and instrumentally valuable. It was supposed to be inherently valuable because it made those who learned and practiced it good, beautiful, and effective, and these were values in themselves, and it was instrumentally valuable because it was useful in helping you to get your way politically. It was precisely this orientation of rhetoric toward human improvement, not just effective instrumental manipulation, that made some of the original forms of rhetorical training such an easy target for Plato's criticism. Plato was terrified by what he took to be the potentially subversive democratic implications of rhetoric. Anyone who could pay the fees, regardless of their genealogy and their family connections, could learn the art of speaking persuasively from teachers of rhetoric. Nevertheless, Plato couches his criticism of rhetoric in epistemological terms. If the study of rhetoric really makes people better people, then surely, Plato argues, the teachers of rhetoric must be able to explain what the human good is and how the study of rhetoric conduces to helping people to attain it. Since rhetoricians had general theories about a lot of things, but they had no general theory of the human good, Plato's conclusion is that they did not know what they were doing and hence could not be doing it well except by accident. Seen retrospectively from the standpoint of the 21st century, there seems nothing extravagant in the claims of professors of rhetoric that they were making those whom they thought better people. After all, they were making them more able to participate effectively in public debate and in the common political life of their respective cities, and that might perfectly well be thought to be something that was good in itself. Isn't Plato's Protagoras, in some sense, right to say that a human who is capable of taking part in a sociable common life is better off than one who is condemned to a life of solitude, isolation, and silence? Similarly, there seems nothing outrageous in thinking that one might reasonably claim to know that one was benefiting people, even though one could not specify through appeal to a general theory in what exact way that was happening. I might very well think that I'm benefiting you and not be able to give you the theory, which is the theory from which it follows that what I'm doing is the right thing to benefit you. Given our complete inability, despite over 2,000 years of effort, to agree on a theory of the good that would have satisfied Plato, it seems highly rash to continue to claim that possession of such a theory is a precondition for any stable form of good practice. That brings me to the second of the two huge millstones that ground away at the interest in origins, namely philosophy. The standard doxographic account of the origins of philosophy goes back to Aristotle's Metaphysics, and it runs more or less as follows. First, there were myths and poetic cosmologies, structured as narratives or genealogies, like those of Hesiod. Then at some point, Thales of Miletus initiated philosophy precisely by breaking with mythic and genealogical accounts, and by claiming that there was a single principle, a single arche, he calls it, a single arche for everything in the world. There was a single explanatory principle, and that is what Thales calls water. Now, he didn't mean by water when he called the arche of the world water, the liquid substance you see in the sea. He meant some abstract entity. We don't exactly know what it was he meant, but he did mean clearly something that wasn't simply identical with what we know as water. Arche derives from the verb archo, which means to make a beginning, to initiate, to take the lead, and then by natural association, to control or rule. The dancer who makes the beginning, in some sense, sets the tempo and determines the nature of the dance. For Homer, he who made the beginning of a person is first of all his father, and then his paternal lineage. And that is what determines who and what the person is. But with Thales, arche begins to take the meaning of a determining abstract principle, leaving behind the idea that there is an interesting historical sequence that can be traced back to some initiatory moment. Now, as I said, we don't exactly know how Thales thought that water constituted the nature of the world or the central explanatory principle, but it turns out that that's not very important. Hegel remarks that when Thales says all is water, he's neither specifying an origin in the way in which Glaucus was specifying an origin when he talked about his genealogy, nor is he making a statement that has the same structure as the statement, all the fish in this barrel are codfish, when it's made by the holder of a market stall. When the holder of a market stall says, all the fish in this barrel are cod, he means take any fish and it's going to be a cod. When Thales says, all is water, we don't exactly know what he did mean, but he certainly didn't mean that. He didn't mean take anything you want and it's going to turn out to be a piece of water. Water is not, as I said, the colorless liquid that fills the Aegean Sea, but is some speculative principle which stands in an unspecified relation to that well-known fluid. All is water is making a totalizing claim, a claim that everything in the world can in some sense be accounted for by reference to this single abstract principle, whatever it is. And simply having had that thought, Hegel claims, was enough to initiate what we've now come to call philosophy. So we've encountered two different senses of origin. First, origin in the sense of historical origination, as in the case of Glaucus, and second, origin in the sense of some explanatory scheme or principle which provides a unitary account or a rationale of something, as in the case of Thales. The overwhelming traditional view in philosophy has been that one only has an adequate understanding of a phenomenon if one has a general theory, or if one can give an abstract rationale for the phenomenon. So if one wants to call a search for the best understanding of something an inquiry into its origin, then the term origin has its second, not its first, sense. That is, a good account gives a unitary principle and certainly not anything that looks like a sequential narrative. Kant sums up a long philosophical tradition in rejecting any important positive role for history in philosophical reflection. Rather, he construes the task of giving the origin of philosophy as that of providing a single rationale for that, for philosophy, and he tries to connect that rationale with a set of universal and invariant human interests. These interests require that human beings try to attain a unitary view of the world as a whole. The reason he thinks this is that for Kant, human agents have to act in the world, and this requires them to make some assumptions about what the world is like, and one of those assumptions is that everything in the world somehow holds together in a way that is explainable. So we have a kind of natural tendency to want to find a single explanatory principle for everything. And that's grounded in this need that we have to act in the world and therefore to understand the world in a surveyable way. Several 19th century Neo-Kantian philosophers developed this thought into a theory of what came to be called the metaphysical need. which was supposed to be the need for a single universal scheme that will make all things make sense. And this metaphysical need was then construed by those who believed that it existed as a continuing human need for the kind of cognitive and normative orientation that could only be given by something like a religious or a philosophical worldview. Kant's most important successor, Hegel, represents a significant break with this by virtue of his attempt to think about philosophy in a more inherently historical way. In one of his early essays, he says that the need for philosophy arises not, as Kant thought, out of some metaphysical constitution of the human person, not historically for all rational agents, but by virtue of agents living in very specific social circumstances. Namely, the need for philosophy arises, as he says, when life itself has lost its unity. So there are particular social circumstances of conflict, and only under those particular social circumstances of conflict where life has lost its unity do we have a need for the kind of general reflection that Kant defined philosophy as being. This raises, of course, the un-Kantian possibility, which fascinated several later philosophers in the Hegelian tradition, most notably perhaps Marx, the possibility that in a completely satisfactory society, philosophy, along with religion, would become superfluous and would disappear. Because if you had a society that was properly functioning and that wasn't riven by conflict, if your life had sufficient unity, you wouldn't need to construct that kind of unity by having a philosophical view of it. The world would make sense in itself. It would be transparent in some way and completely absorbing. And you wouldn't need religion, you wouldn't need philosophy. As I told the usual Aristotelian story about the origin of philosophy, it arises in Thales. However, it's notable that although that's Aristotle's story, Plato gives a different story about the origin of philosophy. He thinks that philosophy really starts with Socrates, and it really gets going when Socrates turns his back on speculation about the nature of the natural world and turns to ethics. In Plato's Phaedo, Plato has Socrates say of himself that when he was young and immature, he concerned himself with speculation about the world, but now that he's become an adult, he is no longer interested in the structure of the universe. He's interested only in how things need to be for the best. So not how the world is constituted, but how it would be best for certain things to be. And the concept of something being for the best, he thinks, is a distinct concept, and philosophy is really about that. Plato didn't himself follow Socrates in his turn away from cosmological speculation. So Plato thinks that's how philosophy starts. It starts with the turn to ethics. But though that's the way it starts, he's not going to go that way. He turns against this Socratic mode, doesn't follow Socrates in his turn away from cosmological speculation, but in fact he develops a highly peculiar theory about the cosmological basis of values. That's the theory that's called the theory of forms or the theory of ideas. This notion of a conjunction between cosmology and ethics developed especially long legs when it was taken over and adopted by Christianity, because Christians construed their God as both the creator of the natural world and the moral legislator. So if you understood the mind of God, you'd understand both of those things. I simply note that it's highly peculiar to think that these two distinct topics, speculation on the nature of the universe and moral and political philosophy, on the other hand, get put together in one subject, philosophy. I just point out that that's a very strange thing, it seems to me. Once a unity like philosophy gets itself established, especially institutionally established, for instance in schools or universities, there's an almost irresistible temptation to find or create a single unitary genealogy for this enterprise, which means both a unitary history and a unitary goal. there's a kind of compulsion to make up a single rationale and project it back onto people who are then retrospectively declared to have been precursors. Nietzsche has a notorious line in criticism of all forms of explanation by reference to purported unique origins. He's especially scathing about attributions of the origins of continuing institutions to individual heroic founders. Philosophy founded by Thales or by Socrates, Christianity founded by Jesus or by Paul, etc. There was never a single origin of anything that had any continuing historical significance. What looks like such a unique origin always disperses into a multiplicity if you look at it more carefully. All persisting institutions and practices have unsurveyable multiple sequences of contingent ancestors. One can in principle trace these ancestors back indeterminately far into the past, and the further back one goes, the more such ancestors there will be. At some point, one will not be able to go any further, but that's merely an accidental limitation, either of the evidence that happens to be available or of our cognitive powers. It's just an accident. We can't go any further. It would not be surprising if the discipline of philosophy depended for its continued vitality on the tension between these different poles, that is, between interest in the structure of the natural world and interest in what would be for the best. So that without this tension, the practice as we knew it would not continue to exist, but would break up into individual parts, and each one would go its own way as a separate discipline. There seems, in fact, to be no particular reason anymore why those concerned to understand the structure of the natural world should ex officio also have a non-trivial interest in which political institutions or which works of art are best. Philosophy could then dissolve itself into physics and the biological sciences on the one hand, and politics, belles lettres, and social psychology on the other. And I strongly suspect that a radical dissociation between these interests has already occurred, although many people have not noticed it yet. And the discipline of philosophy in its present configuration is held together only by a combination of historical inertia and a sentimentalized attachment to a mostly illusory image of past glory. As a purported single subject, philosophy seems unlikely to last. And if the various components really do have as little to do with each other as they nowadays seem to, that might not be a bad thing. If this is true about philosophy, it's true in spades about the humanities. The term the humanities, in the sense in which it's used today in the English-speaking countries, seems not to go back much further than the middle of the 19th century. And we've heard this morning these distinguished contributions about the history of that term. And to say anything substantial about why it came into use would require more interest in and knowledge of 19th century Britain than I possess. But it seems plausible to expect that at least one of the immediate pressures operating was the result of the demands of education, again, as in the ancient world, especially higher education. What does seem, however, to be rather clear, even to an outsider, is that the idea that there's one discernible thing, one discernible collective thing, the humanities, as a more or less unitary set of subjects or disciplines that belong together, required a highly constructive act of conceptualization, putting together various disparate things that had not antecedently been thought to have anything particular to do with each other. In conclusion, I suggest that if the general perspective on our historical situation, which I've tried to sketch, is correct, that is, if philosophy, in fact, is on the point of dissolving into a number of different constituents and has long lost any organic or systematic connection as a discipline with the so-called humanities, and if a similar fragmentation of the humanities themselves as a coherent domain of different disciplines is underway, if that's true, then the whole question of giving some general account of the role of philosophy in the humanities doesn't make much sense. Neither of the two purported entities in question has the requisite stability to admit of a useful investigation of this question. At the moment, the relation between what's called philosophy and what we call the humanities is a matter of idiosyncratic associations between certain individuals who associations which are so contingent that they border on the whimsical. The odd professor of ethics who also happens to have read Greats at Oxford rather than PPE, or the don who works professionally on some aspect of the philosophy of language but also happens to be devoted to the ballet. Whether or not this dissociation is a temporary phenomenon, and if it's not, what new structures will eventually emerge is a matter of speculation. But since such controlled speculation was once one of the things that philosophers used to do, I would suggest that if there is no ecological or economic catastrophe or something comparable that radically overturns our intellectual life, dispersal of the kind I've described is likely to be a continuing feature of our landscape for the foreseeable future.